how do we use our endless grief to fuel our resistance? I recently read Charles Frazier's book, 13 Moons, and it's about a character who lives through most of the 19th century in North Carolina. And very much of it is about a love of the land. And it's about how the land is being destroyed. And this person that begins the story with much of North Carolina still a wilderness. And at the end of the story, he lives next to a train track. And he sees trains go by every way with big old trees on them. Big old trees going one direction and tourists coming the other. And as he is getting ready to die of old age, he talks about how in traditional societies and what humans have lived with for almost all of our existence, you live and you experience personal loss and then you die. But ecologically, things pretty much stay the same. As he says, a few big trees die and fall over, and a few smaller trees get bigger. Yes, your family, you know, your parents die, other people in your community die, but the land is always there. And for the last several thousand years in civilization, and for the last 500 years on this continent, we've not had to deal just with that. And he talks about this. He says, what do you do when everything you know is dying? Everything you know is being killed. Everything you love is being killed. Every piece of land you love is being killed. And I have a hard time reading books written in the 19th century because, and in North Carolina, there were still passenger pigeons at that time. And they're gone. And I have a hard time watching movies from down in the 1930s because in the 1930s, there were still salmon and the salmon are going. And how do you live with that? And more importantly, how do you use that to fuel your resistance? So that's the context in which we're all living, is a world with disappearing amphibians, with the Great Barrier Reef being destroyed, with songbirds going. You know, I've read so many accounts of what these forests were like, these forests where I live were like prior to conquest. And people would say it sounded like a menagerie. There were so many animals talking at night that they would keep you awake. I think about that. I thought about that last night. I think about it almost every night as I walk through a forest, almost silent. And I will never forget someone I met I gave a talk in 1995, 1996, 1997, somewhere in there. I gave a talk in Minnesota, very short talk about this culture killing the planet. And this one woman who's an anti-pesticide activist came up to me afterwards. And she said, sometimes I feel like the only things that keep me going are rage and sorrow. And I respect that. And I respect, what I respect is the fact that she goes on. And what I respect is the fact that she uses that rage and sorrow and love, obviously, to fuel our activism. I get really tired of people who say that the most important thing we can do is to grieve the losses. And one of the reasons that I get so upset at that is because they're missing a step, which is resistance. The world's not dead yet. And you don't fully grieve as long as there's work still to be done. You know, when I was 24, I had a very, very bad bout of Crohn's disease. And I was dying. And I was in a hospital in Nevada, and the doctors were killing me, and the disease was killing me. And my mom was thinking of moving to England. She was in the UK at the time, And she got a call from the woman I was dating at the time saying, you know, your son's dying. If you want to see him, you better come back. And my mom flew back to the United States, did not rest at all, drove. Well, she called what is now the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. It had a different name back then. And she said what tests the doctors were doing, what surgery the doctors were going to do, what procedures the doctors were doing. And at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, they said, they're killing him. Get him out of there. So she called the hospital in Salt Lake City and said, this is what's happening. They said, bring him over. We will send a helicopter. The people at the hospital in Elko, Nevada, refused to allow the hospital, the helicopter to land. And they refused to do anything. They refused to discharge me, actually. And so my mom flew in from the UK, landed in Salt Lake City, drove 4 hours to Elko, went into the hospital, pulled the tubes out of my arms, physically carried me down to the car, and then drove 4 hours back to Salt Lake City where they were waiting with a gurney. And the point is, she was desperately sad because her youngest son was dying. But she didn't just say, oh, my youngest son is dying, and cry. She rolled up her sleeves and got to work. And that's what you do until there is no breath left. That's what you do until after there is no breath left and you have tried everything you can. If you have 3 children and you are in a home and there is an axe murderer in another room who has already killed one of your children and is in the process of killing the other 2 children, you don't stop and deal with your grief. There is a time for grief. What you do is you stop the axe murder using any means necessary. And yes, passenger pigeons are gone, and that breaks my heart. And there are many runs of salmon gone, and that breaks my heart. There are species of frogs who are gone, and that breaks my heart. But there are other species of frogs who are not gone, and they need your help. And what happens in the real world is more important than my grief at every moment. And so, yes, people ask me how I deal with all of the sorrow. I cry. I cry a lot. I feel sad a lot. And then I get to work. And I think it's really important to I've talked about this in a lot of my talks, how I had a very important conversation with Jeanette Armstrong back when I was a fairly young activist. Maybe I'd been an activist for 5-6 years maybe. And Jeanette Armstrong has been doing this literally since before she was born. And excuse me, I called her up one day and I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. And I said, yeah, it'll do that. And I said, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. And I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And then she said the best possible thing she could say, which is, she said, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best possible thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. There's this idea that if you acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around feeling miserable all the time. But that's just not true. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that things are really, really bad and that life is still really good and that there is much out there that is worth fighting for. And so for me, and here's what I also found out, is that it took more energy for me to avoid that despair than it does to actually feel it and then move on and get to work. And so for me, the important thing is not to, the role of grieving is for us not to avoid that grief, to feel it. Because if we don't, it's going to take a lot of energy, and we will end up also then promoting all sorts of counterproductive solutions that are attempts to avoid feeling the despair. For example, solar panels, windmills, all sorts of things that make us feel, that act primarily to make it so we don't feel how bad things are. Oh, we can fix them if we just change the source of energy. So the role of despair and of sorrow is to help push us past those false hopes, to get us. See, one of the things I also used to say all the time is that there's a wonderful thing about recognizing how bad things are, is that you can recognize that and you learn that it doesn't kill you to feel it. You can feel it and you can still sing and you can still, and you can feel it and it doesn't kill you. We all think, oh my God, this is going to just kill us if we acknowledge the depth of the horror. No, you just go on. And then you actually go on more effective than you were before. It's like if my mom would have not given up on the doctors in Elko, if she would have just tried to avoid feeling the sorrow, she would have been stuck in doing nothing. But instead, it's like, okay, I'm feeling the sorrow. Now, what am I going to do about it? Because there are still things to do. And there's another part of this too, which is that if you feel all those things, if you feel how bad things are, a part of you does die. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Once you're dead, there's a great poem by the Zen poet Bunan, die while you're alive and be absolutely dead, then do whatever you want, it's all good. And what that is when you're belief in the system itself dies. It's like, okay, what are we going to do now? That's what had to die with my mom, the faith in those particular doctors. It's like, okay, what are we going to do now? And that's where I want for us to get to, is to just say, okay, what are we going to do now? And for that, I think we fall into the grief, but at every moment, we are aware. You know, if I were to spend all my time grieving the death of the passenger pigeons, I think the salmon would go, what are we, chopped liver? I mean, it's like, we're still here. And think about this. You've seen this in movies, and probably some people have seen it in real life, where the death of one child and the parents grieving that one child harms the other children, who now say, hello, we're still here. Why are you sad all the time? And yes, there is that hole. It's as a friend of mine said when a dear dog friend died, she said, you will have a hole in your heart the size of that dog friend. And that's true. But there are others here too, and we need to fight for them.